cases had the right to an attorney paid for by the state. It said that legal representation was a fundamental right necessary for a fair trial. The landmark case Gideon v. Wainwright has been expanded over the last half century, and there's a movement to include civil cases. But funding has become a persistent problem in a number of states, including here in Pennsylvania, and questions have been raised about the qualifications and shortage of attorneys representing poor clients. Today on Radio Times, Gideon at 50, and we have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Mark Bookman is director of the Atlantic Center for Capital Representation. That's a nonprofit that provides services free of charge to capital defense lawyers in Pennsylvania and in Delaware. He spent many years as a public defender. And Mark Bookman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Also with us is Catherine Carr, Executive Director of Community Legal Services of Philadelphia. She's also co-chair of the Philadelphia Bar Association Civil Gideon and Access to Justice Task Force. And Kathy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
And rounding out our trio of guests is James Funt, partner in the Philadelphia law firm of Greenblatt, Pierce, Funt, and Flores. Began his career as a trial lawyer with the Defenders Association of Philadelphia, and he's chair of the Criminal Justice Section of the Philadelphia Bar Association. And Jamie, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It is my pleasure.
Well, let me go back to 1961 to Clarence Earl Gideon. He was arrested, and I'll begin with you, Jamie. What was he arrested for?
Mr. Gideon was a 51-year-old, frail, nonviolent guy, sort of a drifter, who was arrested and charged with burglary of a pool hall. The allegation was based on rather flimsy hearsay testimony of an individual who may, in fact, have been the perpetrator. And based just on that flimsy evidence, he was arrested, tried, and ultimately convicted of burglary and was sentenced to 5 years in prison.
And this was in Florida?
This was in Florida, in Panama City.
And he was, in a sense, had to represent himself in the courtroom.
Indeed. What happened was that during the course, before the trial began, he specifically asked the court for legal representation. And then there was a back and forth between the judge and Mr. Gideon. The judge basically told him that because it was not a death penalty matter, that he was not entitled to counsel. And he simply, with a one-line statement, the United States Supreme Court says, I'm entitled to be represented by counsel. That was his one-line statement. It was denied. And based on that, we sit here today.
That's a powerful statement for a person, an indigent person, to say.
Sure is.
And he did. He went to prison, Kathy.
Yes, he went to prison, but then he appealed the case, and it was at the Supreme Court level where he was actually provided with counsel to argue the issue of whether or not he had been entitled to counsel in the lower court. And he won that, and he went back, and when he was tried again, with a competent counsel who represented him, it was a completely different kind of trial. In this trial, the jury went out for 1 hour and came back and found that he was not guilty. The evidence that was presented at that second trial, when he had an attorney, was compelling, and was frankly made the case quite simple, and he got off easily. And I think what's important is showing the tremendous difference that having a competent lawyer the second time around made in whether he was going to spend years in jail or whether he was innocent.
Well, Mark, and just picking up on this story, and then I do want to get to present day. Interestingly, it was Abe Fortas who argued his case before the U.S. Supreme Court. A good lawyer to have, yes?
A great lawyer to have, yes.
And what was Abe Fortas's argument to the justices?
Well, I think ultimately he simply said that, he basically made the moral and compelling argument, and really the argument that Kathy just made, that a lawyer makes a huge difference, and we can't distinguishing between a capital case or even a murder case and someone going to jail for 5 years, as Gideon did, is not a fair distinction when you're talking about not having a lawyer at all. His argument, the court had only 12 or 13 years earlier said no to his argument. But in that 12 years, things had changed and the court had changed. And it was a pretty easy decision at that point in 1963.
Well, Jamie, this is called a landmark decision. Does it meet that? Many decisions are called landmark. Is this truly a landmark decision?
Indeed it is. Based on this decision, it spearheaded the creation of public defender's offices throughout the country, some of which have done rather well. The Philadelphia Public Defender's Office is a model. And there are others that don't do so well based on – and everyone has to deal with the constant issue of funding, which I know we all want to talk about as we go forward. The great thing about that decision was that a uneducated man with literally a pencil scribing on prison stationery could have access to justice in the highest court of the land is a remarkable celebration, if that's what we're celebrating, right, of our access to justice by indigent people. The question now is, how do we honor what he went through in order to finally get to where we believe that you need to be with access to justice for indigent folk?
Mark, are we celebrating Gideon?
Well, it really does depend on who you talk to. I know we're gonna get to a study that's been making the rounds. It was done by the RAND Corporation. And, you know, Kathy really has the crucial word, which is competent. It's not – Gideon is not really just about putting a lawyer into a courtroom and having that lawyer represent everybody. The lawyer has to be competent. And so what we're really talking about is, are we providing competent counsel for our cases that require them? And, you know, that's a pretty open question at this point, and I think the RAND study really pointed to the fact that maybe we're not oftentimes providing competent counsel.
And this was a study that actually looked at cases in Pennsylvania, yes, in Philadelphia?
This was a study that looked at the homicide cases in Philadelphia from 1994 to 2005. It was the Public Defender's Office in Philadelphia, the Defender Association, takes one out of every five homicides. And the Defender Association has resources that provide two lawyers, several investigators, what we call a mitigation specialist for a capital case, and they work very hard. They prepare the cases very hard, and their results were markedly better than the court-appointed lawyers who do not have the same resources and services at their disposal. Ultimately, that study showed that 61 of defender clients, 61% were less likely to be acquitted. More likely to be acquitted. 19% were more likely to be acquitted entirely. And ultimately, the sentences that defender clients received were 24% lower than the private bar. And what the most important, compelling fact that I think we're going to talk about is that 24% represents a cost of $200 million to the taxpayers in incarceration costs. So we're being very penny wise and pound foolish.
You want to add to that, Kathy, from your perspective?
Yes. Well, I think I'm going to go back to whether you're asking whether this is a celebration. So 50 years from the Gideon decision is certainly a celebration of American justice and a Supreme Court that took a big step at the time and said everyone who's facing significant jail time, felony convictions, is entitled to a lawyer. Now, 50 years later, we're looking really at the quality of that representation. If you don't pay lawyers enough, if you don't come up with funding and say this is an important right that we're going to support with public funds, then what happens is the kinds of cases we've seen where really you get incompetent counsel and the right to a lawyer doesn't mean as much. So I think one of the things here 50 years later that we're looking at is how do you provide really quality counsel? And then I guess the other thing in terms of issues we're looking at 50 years out, which is sort of my piece, I come from the civil side of the law, and whether there are other areas where indigent people and, frankly, Americans in general should have counsel if they're going to be in court on really important matters that threaten their shelter, their safety, their family integrity. There's so many other areas. And, frankly, if you talk to Americans, they think that not only did Gideon give counsel to people in criminal matters, they think in this country where we talk about access to justice for all, they think that includes counsel in very important civil, non-criminal cases.
And I guess we're talking about things like landlord-tenant,
right,
divorce, custody,
right,
cases, those kinds of things?
Exactly. Cases where you're going to lose your house, whether it's mortgage foreclosure or evictions, where you're going to lose your income. Maybe you're a disabled person who's gotten a kind of a disability benefit for decades and it's going to be cut off. If you're going to lose your child and have a termination of parental rights. Now, actually, in Pennsylvania, you do have a right to that. But the U.S. Supreme Supreme Court did not find that that U.S. Constitution absolutely guarantees you a lawyer, even if you're going to lose your child. And think about how losing the right to ever see your child again compares with going to jail for a year. Right.
And the idea of being in court to represent yourself without the assistance of an attorney.
The kind of thing that Gideon went through.
Let me talk with you, Damien, just about funding. I mean, what did the Supreme Court say, and how are these, I guess, Gideon cases, how have they been funded in the last 50 years? I realize it probably varies from state to state.
Well, the decision mandated that individual states have to fund the cases. And that becomes part of a much bigger conversation I think we have to have, you know, dovetailing what Mark talked about, the $200 million in taxpayer wasted funds without competent counsel. What's happened is because when you have an economic pie, you consider the United States an economic engine, and when you are diverting a lot of resources, and it does, the decision mandates that resources that were going somewhere else in some other capacity now have to be diverted towards poor people. That has created a class warfare of some sort where poor people all are lumped together and vilified as just being criminals, however you want to classify it. And that becomes difficult for political will to fund cases that people then say, well, why should I provide my tax dollars to some poor criminal? They lump them together.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working. I have to pay for my own lawyer. So there becomes a real difficulty in trying to convince the powers that be, whether or not they are politicians or courts, to get adequate funds for specific cases, to try and divest ourselves from that internal debate and struggle that we're having. We have to, akin to teachers, teach people that the value of a lawyer — everyone hates lawyers until you need one, you know. Teachers get into it because they love the love of teaching. Public defenders do it because they really believe, by and large, not everyone, but by and large, in what they're doing and the access to justice. And we have to educate people to create the political will to fund the cases better.
This is a very practical question related to Pennsylvania. How does this work in Pennsylvania then?
Again, the state is the overarching economic place where all the funding comes from, but Pennsylvania has decided in its infinite wisdom that individual counties will have to decide how monies get dispersed. It used to be in Philadelphia that the courts were dispersing those funds. Recently, the courts have transferred that responsibility to the city, which has then created additional tensions. The city's recently put out an opportunity for a new RFP, request for proposals, to fund a separate defender office. So those debates have now come in, and there are internal struggles within the politics of how to make that happen.
And we're almost on a break here, but would you say this has had a bigger impact in Philadelphia than maybe other counties, Mark?
Well, Philadelphia is at the – unfortunately, we're at the bottom rung in terms of the way we resource our most serious cases, and I'm now talking about capital cases. We're miles behind, you know, equivalent cities in the way they fund. I'm talking about Los Angeles or Houston other big cities that are equivalent. So we are way behind. And I think, you know, I don't want to beat the same drum, but what the RAND study really tells us is that we're not saving money. You can be smart and good. You can provide good counsel, which is helpful, and be smart about saving money. And that's maybe what we'll talk about after the break.
Maybe we will. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation with Mark Bookman, Catherine Carr, and James Fund. Actually, a very serious discussion about an important issue. We are talking about Gideon v. Wainwright, which was decided 50 years ago this month. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. It will never please the public, said Tchaikovsky of his Fifth Symphony, yet its melodies have captivated for over a century. Andre Boryeko leads a Philadelphia Orchestra specialty, Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony. Tchaikovsky tickets at philorc.org or at 215-893-1999. March 21st, 22nd, and 23rd at the Kimmel Center, Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Hey, Seek in This American Life, why do anything new? Let's face it, we love routine, we want things to stay the same. Reruns are more comforting than regular TV.
Last night, I was watching TV and I couldn't find a rerun anywhere, and I was like panicking and flipping. Oh, there was a rerun though. It was like a rerun of The Nanny was on, and I don't have any relationship with it, so I was like stuck.
I've stuck in reruns this week.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY. author Katherine Patterson has a long list of young adult classics to her credit, but she began her career before her own children were old enough to read them.
A lot is going on in your head when you're changing diapers and doing all those things that have to be done.
Award-winning author Katherine Patterson shares her wisdom about writing next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. On March 18, 1963, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on a landmark case, Gideon v. Wainwright. It said that anyone who is too poor to afford an attorney in a criminal case is entitled to free representation. Today on Radio Times, 50 years after Gideon, what is the state of the right to counsel for indigent clients, especially for those in Pennsylvania? Talking with Mark Bookman, head of the Atlantic Center for Capital Representation. Kathy Carr is head of Community Legal Services of Philadelphia, and Jamie Fund is partner in the law firm of Greenblatt, Pierce, Funt, and Flores. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Kathy, let me go back to you, and only because this RAND study that came out about a year ago is so central to our understanding of, and so central to our conversation. The study basically saying that court-appointed attorneys didn't have the same kind of outcomes as public defenders. I guess besides the money part of that, what does that finding tell us?
It tells us that organized providers of legal representation, be they criminal or civil, and my office is civil, and these two gentlemen are on the criminal side, that the organized providers can do representation in an efficient and effective way. The defenders' offices are nonprofit, as is my civil organization, and there's an efficiency and a competency and accountability by organizations which actually have people in larger offices who are representing people. That's not at all to say that there aren't very competent people who are individually taking court appointments. I want to qualify what I said, which also is the amount you pay people to do these cases is extremely important. On the civil side, some of the places where you have court-appointed counsel, people are making the equivalent of $10, $15 an hour by the time, if they really do a good job. And I'm sure that may be true in the homicide cases as well. If you don't pay lawyers enough, they cannot do the work that is necessary to provide quality representation.
And you come up with that if someone puts in 100 hours on a case,
right.
and they
get $1,000. Well, in family court now, in cases where people are facing the loss of their children because of allegations of abuse or neglect, parents are represented, children are represented. But the system pays several hundred dollars sometimes for a year of representation. And if you want to really go to now you're expected to go to the court several times. You'll go to court several times a year for that few hundred dollars. You want to meet with your clients. You want to do background work, assist them, do investigation, and to do all of that for a few hundred dollars. If you're doing it in a really quality way, you'll end up making just a very small amount of money.
I mean, Jamie, that's an argument for more funding.
It is.
Or different kind of funding,
perhaps. A different kind of funding. And it's when we talk about the funding issue, it's also the number of cases that we're talking about. So public defenders, for example, and I know in Philadelphia, haven't received a raise in, I think, 5 years. The number of cases they may have on a particular day could be upwards of 30, 40, 50 cases.
In one day?
In one day in the municipal courts. And then in the felony courts, it could be 8, 9, 10, 20 cases. It depends on, you know, what kind of cases you have. So to properly investigate and do everything you need to do is a very difficult thing to do for people who are very committed. And I think what happens is a matter of human nature. The defenders themselves, often very committed, or the prosecutors, or even the judges, when they have that many cases in a particular courtroom on a day, start to see everyone in one shade of gray. And they lose the detail of the individual case, and therefore the individual justice that's meted out becomes in a haze. And that's difficult, and it's human nature. When you see that many people coming in, so there are some judges who are very hardworking. Others, you know, maybe they want to be out by lunch. You know, and I'm not disparaging anyone. I think it's human nature that when you have that many cases that you're dealing with, it becomes much more difficult. And that's why Gideon is so interesting. It's a story about an individual person that we can all identify with who got really incompetent counsel. When you bring that competent counsel to a judge's attention or to a jury's attention, you're going to have a much more effective outcome and thereby, on Mark's point, save money on the back end in terms of unnecessary incarceration supervision.
Well, and I wonder to you, Mark, how does the court define indigent? And I can imagine that there are people who are probably poor by almost any standard, who then don't have access, at least to the small access to an attorney, and are essentially left without a lawyer.
Well, to properly handle a death penalty case and even a homicide case is extraordinarily labor intensive, and so I think probably 80% or more of people that are facing those charges are indigent because they can't afford the sort of representation that the United States Supreme Court demands of those cases. So it's a huge percentage that are indigent and need to be provided with competent counsel.
But what about for these civil cases? I guess we're not there yet, Kathy, but I'm wondering, does that mean that people don't appear in court because they don't have representation?
Well, in family court in Philadelphia and in the eviction proceedings in Philadelphia, about 95% of the people who show up and are self-representing. So you may be losing your home, and you are there, and you may have some very good legal claims, but you don't know what they are. So it's not that different from Mr. Gideon's individual case. So people are going into courts by themselves and dealing with the system and frankly, not being able to articulate the claims that they may have.
And it seems like you don't have to be poor not to be able to articulate something in a courtroom.
Absolutely. We'd all like to have a system where people didn't necessarily need lawyers. But the truth is the legal system is complicated, and having a lawyer there with you can make all of the difference, just as it did in Mr. Gideon's case. So that's true on the civil side. And I think just to follow up on the point about the finances of this, I think we need to remember that while a lawyer costs money, the returns to the culture, to the society, often are so large that it absolutely outweighs the cost of having a lawyer. A study done in Pennsylvania on the value of civil legal aid found that for every dollar that we spend on providing somebody with a lawyer has an $11 return. And if you think about it, on keeping people out of jail, clearly, is
like Mr. Gideon, for instance.
Yes, like Mr. Gideon, 5 years of his costs. And similarly, if you can keep a child out of foster care, if you can keep someone in their home and not homeless, those are the kinds of things that have obvious and very direct and immediate cost savings measures. So this is one of these things where I think we're being penny, what's the saying, penny wise and pound foolish, right? And I think that in both the criminal and civil side, that while there's an initial outlay of funding, the returns would make the difference.
Jamie, we've been talking off the air about specialty courts, and I want to add that to our conversation, and then I do want to get some callers in as well. Go ahead.
Sure. Philadelphia actually, there are some successes here. Philadelphia, in order to try and divert the number of cases that were crushing the court system, the district attorney's office and the court system have set up a number of specialty courts, including Veterans Court, a SAM court, which is small amount of marijuana, AMP court, which deals with small misdemeanor cases, and other cases that deal with specific folk that need help. Drug court is another classic example. That takes a huge amount of cases out of the trial system, allows for an effective marshaling of resources to address individual needs, the underlying social issues as to why people may be there to begin with. What that has done is alleviate some of the burden that the public defenders and other court-appointed lawyers have on the cases, and they can focus what they really need to do on the specific cases. Now, do I think that that has been getting inspired? No. I think that's more of a function of the economic realities and the underfunding of the system, and they're looking, how do we figure out our best use of resources? But there are good examples. And on the civil side, Volunteers for the Indigent, run by the Bar Association, again, are ideas on how to marshal pro bono resources in order to help out alleviate that burden and provide access to justice.
But the idea that you would have judges that specialize in these kinds of cases and perhaps lawyers that also specialize in these kinds of cases?
Not so much. There's some judges that deal with, like, in mental health court and veterans court that do have specific information and experience. And so they bring a lot of great information to bear on those courses, on those specific cases. But the district attorney's office has set it up, and with the public defender's mm-hmm. office, in order to figure out how do we best allocate our resources for these cases. We're talking about nonviolent offenders. How do we marshal those? And so ultimately, we mm-hmm. can focus on the real cases, the cases that, you know, the real serious violent offenses where we really need to focus and protect society from those very violent folk versus those who really don't need that, need more treatment, rehabilitation, job training, education, those issues.
Mark, anything you want to add to that?
Just that I think when you talk about specialization, I mean, that's a really important aspect of at least my perception of this, which is, you know, at doing death penalty cases, specialization is really critical. I mean, that's another thing that separated out the court-appointed mm-hmm. Under-resourced lawyers from the defender unit, homicide unit, which was very specialized. Kathy even, you know, referenced this in the civil area. Really knowing, that specific area of the law is critically important to the outcomes. And these outcomes are important. It's not just to us. I mean, your listeners should understand good outcomes are important, you know, to victims' families and you know, having cases finalized is a very, very good thing in our system. And we're not seeing that so much in Philadelphia sometimes.
Let me reintroduce the three of you. And I do want to give out that phone number again. And that's Mark Bookman. He's director of the Atlantic Center for Capital Representation, again, a nonprofit that provides services free of charge to capital defense lawyers here in Pennsylvania, also in Delaware. He was a public defender for 27 years. Catherine Carr, Executive Director of the Community Legal Services of Philadelphia, co-chair of the Philadelphia Bar Association Civil Gideon and Access to Justice Task Force, and James Funt, partner in the Philadelphia law firm of Greenblatt, Pierce, Funt, and Flores, and he's chair of the Criminal Justice Section of the Philadelphia Bar Association, a mouthful, but important to know our guests' credentials, and we are talking about Gideon v. Wainwright. 50 years ago this month, the Supreme Court ruled that poor people charged with a felony were entitled to government-financed legal representation. We're talking about what the court ruled then and where some of these issues stand today, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What do you think? Let me get George from, looks like, Freehold, New Jersey to join us. And George, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Yes. I was wondering if there are some people in Congress who are pushing for additional funds so that those of us who are interested can get in touch with the right people.
The idea that if they're, and we're talking in, I guess, sequester land as well, I don't know whether, Jamie, do you know if there are efforts to expand funding, at least?
I there are efforts. Whether or not they're going to be successful in this day and age of sequester and whether or not that sequester is a real or imagined economic reality is a different question. But the answer to that, I think, is we all need to be much more vocal with our specific representatives, whether or not that is local or state mm-hmm. or in Congress. Identify who they are and advocate for that. It is a difficult discussion to have when you're talking about poor people, you know, and then poor people involved
with
the allegation of criminal defense. I mean, look, there are many people who may very well be guilty of what they're charged. There are many who are not. There are many who are maybe guilty of something far lighter than what their accusation may be. And sifting that out requires an attorney's attention, and it requires mm-hmm. resources.
Well, and Mark, even going back to what the court said with Gideon, is that legal representation was a fundamental right necessary for a fair trial.
Yeah.
Whether someone is guilty or not.
There's no question about that, but I just want to reemphasize, we can be smart and good. Being good is you know, respecting this fundamental right and making sure we have competent counsel. But at the same time, that is smart, because we are ultimately going to save taxpayer money through lower incarceration rates and many other things by properly funding.
Kathy, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I like the question. I think the problem right now is a problem across many, many areas of our lives, which is during the recession, finding funding for things that really matter to us. And I guess I just want to point out that this is something that really, really should matter to Americans. This is how we define ourselves as the country in the world that respects justice, that we teach our five-year-olds to talk about liberty and justice for all in our Pledge of Allegiance. Our Constitution is about justice for all. And so, and yet we really are not coming up with the funding for it. I once heard the counsel to the Secretary of State talk about how important it was when he goes to China to be able to talk about the justice system in the United States as something that we can be proud of. And frankly, right now, there are holes in our justice system.
But I can imagine someone listening to our show who's not poor but not rich. They need a lawyer, and they're looking at $200 an hour. I mean, it seems that it's difficult. It's expensive to have representation, whether you're rich or poor, or middle class or poor.
And I want to say that the Bar Association, the Philadelphia Bar Association, which is working on these issues, and the American Bar Association, which is working on these issues, all of the attorneys are concerned about bringing justice to the accessibility of justice in lawyers, not just to the poorest of the poor, but to middle-class people as well. There's very much a realization that the court systems now need to be designed in a way that people can access them.
Go ahead, Mark.
You know what, Marty, you're talking about $200 an hour. It's not necessarily that expensive. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court asked Judge Lerner from Philadelphia to conduct hearings on the state of capital defense in Philadelphia. Judge Lerner ultimately recommended an hourly rate of $90 an hour for court-appointed counsel in Philadelphia. That would be a marked increase over what we have, but certainly moderate by any standards, I think, for paying lawyers.
Well, and Jamie, anything you want to add to that? I mean, I realize it's not Gideon, but
no,
it just feels like it's very expensive to have an attorney.
It can be. And I think that's what also – I mean, if you're a working individual – and you ask yourself, why should my hard-paying tax dollars go to some, you know, individual for free when I have to work in order to pay? That's the class warfare that I'm talking about.
Right.
And I think we need to all come together to figure out how – and that's why the study that was recommended by Judge Lerner, I think, was a really effective one. In the federal system, there is an hourly rate when you work for court-appointed counsel. I think it's $125 an hour. Again, a rate that probably is low based on the high-quality work that they do, but enough where it attracts some of the best minds. And therefore, when you look at the rates of incarceration, you look at the outcomes, you look at the quality of work, the federal system has done a cost-saving analysis, and the state system should be doing the same thing.
But I'm not sure who to toss this to in about a minute before our second break here, but what constitutes, I guess, competent – a competent attorney? What kind of skills do they need to have, Kathy?
Well, I think part of what we're talking about in this situation is adequate time, right? And I think that that's where the funding comes in. Competent counsel has to be able to afford and to have the time to put in your case, to do the necessary preparation, investigation, and presentation on your behalf. And, you know, there's the occasional case of lawyers who really don't know what they're doing or who fall asleep. Those are aberrations. I think what we're talking about mainly is making sure that there's adequate funding for lawyers to spend the time that's necessary to get to know the case, to know the client, and to do an appropriate defense in court.
Well, let's take that very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Looks like we have a pretty much a full bank of calls here at 1-888-477-9499. Talking with Kathy Carr, Executive Director of Community Legal Services of Philadelphia. Jamie Fund, a partner in the Philadelphia law firm of Greenblatt, Pierce, Funt, and Flores. And Mark Bookman, Director of the Atlantic Center for Capital Representation. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Passage Theater supports WHYY and presents Roundelay, a comic, globe-hopping tale about people doing whatever it takes to make love happen, by R.N. Sandberg, March 21st through April 7th, in Trenton, 609-392-0766 or passagetheater.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Mohsen Hamid talks about his new novel, How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. The answer for his main character is by passing off boiled tap water as expensive bottled mineral water in a city which closely resembles Lahore, Pakistan, where Mohsen Hamid lives. His previous novel, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, has been made into a movie. Join us. This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Critics of gun laws say they don't work, but a new study from Children's Hospital Boston says states with the most gun laws have lower rates of deaths from guns. Also, Grammy Award-winning violist Kim Kashkashian. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY, an affiliate of the Penn Cancer Network, offering access to complex treatment options, clinical trials, a multidisciplinary team approach, and helpful nurse navigators. ChesterCountyHospital.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. 50 years ago this month, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in a case called Gideon v. Wainwright that indigent people charged in a criminal case had the right to an attorney paid for by the state. And we are talking about Gideon then and now and some of the questions raised about access to competent attorneys and the wherewithal to be able to represent poor people in court. Let me see what looks like Sadie from Schwenksville has to say. And Sadie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Hi there. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I actually left court this morning in Montgomery County and have experienced the same thing. I'm highly fortunate because I have a family friend who is my lawyer, but I sit there and it's like about 80 cases all in one courtroom, and the public defenders are just scrambling. I mean, they are entirely overwhelmed. I think it's crazy because I've gone to court three times now because my lawyer, who I'm, you know, is not a public defender, the court systems are so, I guess, maybe confused, or there's so much miscommunication that my own case, even though I have a great lawyer, has been pushed off and pushed aside just due to the entire, I guess, miscommunication, confusion, overwhelmingness of the public defender's office.
Well, that's interesting. So. Sadie, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and she is currently in the Montgomery County court system. Mark, anything you want to add to what Sadie said?
You know, I don't want to make any judgments about what Sadie has experienced. I will say that the Defender Association of Philadelphia is one of the best offices in the country, and they really have the results to back it up in a death penalty context. I know that's not what Sadie's talking about.
Right.
The Defender Association has never taken a single death verdict where the private bar has taken over 100, I think, at this point. So, I mean, we don't want to generalize too much about public defenders being confused. I think if they're properly resourced, they're the best lawyers you can have, among the best lawyers you can have.
And just reading what's on my computer screen, that from her perspective, public defenders are short-staffed and overwhelmed, which I think is speaking to what we were talking about earlier, Kathy.
Yeah, and I want to point out that it's not just the defender staff and the lawyers who are representing people that are under pressure. The court systems, frankly, are under pressure right now. They're underfunded. We don't have enough judges in many courts. So the whole system right now is overburdened. Again, and during the recession, things have gotten worse.
Let me get it looks like Mark from Brookhaven to join us. And Mark, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My situation is such that I have a case, it's technically a felony, up in Connecticut that I've been dealing with. I'm among what you would call the working poor. And it costs me almost $200 every time I have to drive up there to go to court, and I've been on the docket 10 times. Part of the process has been that I can't afford or couldn't afford an attorney, and I thought I would be able to be applied for a public defender, and I wasn't eligible because I'm working. And what happened then was that the judge told me I had to have an attorney. I told him I wasn't eligible, and he said I had to have one, and that he would incarcerate me, which would then cost me my job, which then would make me eligible for a public defender. And I just think that's crazy.
Well, Mark, we're all looking at each other. I'm looking at Jamie Funt here, and that sounds crazy.
Yeah, it actually, I have seen the what Mark is going through any number of times. We do work in Pennsylvania, also New Jersey, and that does happen all too often. Again, I think there's a dehumanization that occurs when the courts are overwhelmed and they see a huge docket. And they get annoyed at the individual litigant, even though just in Mark's situation, he's doing the best he possibly can. Mm-hmm. He can't afford counsel. You can't attract an attorney to be able to come and deal with the case for the minimal fee that Mark would be able to afford. And so that goes to the issue that Kathy and Mark are talking about now, which is a diversion of resources, penny wise, pound foolish, because now do we incarcerate Mark, take him away from his job, therefore he can't pay a mortgage to support his kids, all because a judge wants to make a point and scare individual litigants that you better get an attorney, or encourage, worse than that, a guilty plea. And I can't tell you how many times I've seen people plead guilty to something they may not have done because the consequences are so draconian and they get scared. And it becomes a cost-benefit analysis. Do I keep coming to court and therefore waste all the resources that I have? Or do I get this over with even though I may not have done this? And that happens all too frequently.
Wow. Anyone with any advice for Mark, Kathy, or at least a comment for Mark?
Well, I was going to follow up on what Jamie said in terms of the costs of these kinds of things. So now if Mark is pressured into pleading guilty and then has a conviction on his record, then what we see later on is that Mark, when he tries to go back to his employment, is now going to have a conviction on his record, which may make his employer not want to keep him employed any longer. And we on the civil side are then dealing with the costs of that. The huge number of Americans who have criminal convictions, which then get in the way of their ability to be self-sustaining and employed.
Mm. If I can just follow
Jamie,
up on that, that's a really excellent point, because of the dearth of resources for individual criminal lawyers, there are a lot of ancillary consequences to convictions. And just what Kathy, she is left held holding that bag, and individuals like Mark have to deal with those consequences. Mm-hmm. And if you don't adequately explain those to people, they don't know them, and then they step into a much bigger problem that they never were aware of. And providing the resources to explain that, the time, again, to what Mark Bookman and Kathy are saying, to give that attention to your individual client is crucial. So if they plead guilty, it's a complete knowing, intelligent, and voluntary one based on all the potential consequences, driving consequences, whether or not you can see your children, because there are certain cases now where it affects custody rights, professional licenses. All of that is implicated on criminal convictions.
Yeah, Mark, anything you want to add to that?
Just our best judges and our best defender offices recognize that the more serious the crime, the more labor intensive it's going to be, and the more hours and cost it's going to have. So in a situation like Mark's, who is facing a felony out of state, a judge should be able to recognize that that's going to be more expensive than the a steal in a candy bar out of a local delicatessen. So it's important for our judges and our defender offices as well to be able to be flexible and appoint lawyers when it is going to be smart to do so.
Mark, good luck, and thanks for calling into Radio Times. I see what Jane from Cape May Courthouse has to say. Jane, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I was a legal services attorney on the civil side for about 25 years, and I just started a nonprofit to provide legal services to low-income and middle-income people on a sliding fee basis. Unfortunately, after 2 years, we couldn't get any funding for it.
Really?
And I'm just thinking that that's, we got to look at other ways of providing poor people with representation, middle-income people with representation. Now I'm in private practice, and so many people I have to turn away that it's we have to come up with a better funding models, and maybe a public-private partnership of looking at it on a sliding fee would be an alternative.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'm tossing your comment to Kathy. Go ahead.
Yes, I think that the dearth of representation on the civil side is something that we at this 50th anniversary of Gideon, we are starting to talk about, and how do we move forward with providing more counsel on the civil side. Even for indigent people who are served by organizations, legal aid organizations like mine, studies have repeatedly shown that only about 20% of the legal needs of that population are covered. And then, as Jane is pointing out, you've got the next level of people who perhaps are not so indigent that they can get legal aid services, but still need lawyers, and as Marty points out, that at prices that are hard to afford. There is work being done to figure out how to make the court system more accessible, to make it easier for people to do some things themselves, make it easier for lawyers to represent people in certain pieces of work. We call it limited representation, so that maybe there's a piece of an action that Jane can handle for someone and be paid for without taking on the whole case. I think this is an area that the bar is really thinking forward about, and really at the same time, though, I do believe that we, as a culture, have to be willing to put some funding into it and to recognize that we don't just pay for courthouses and judges. We also have to pay for people to have the lawyers in them.
Well, this sort of adds a whole other level, but what about law schools? I mean, here's a, you know, possible, and I'm looking at you, Mark, a way to maybe rethink law schools or to train lawyers to deal with some of these cases as they're taking classes.
Some of our law schools law schools across the country are clearly under fire. I mean, people the population of people that are applying to those schools is going down. There's some talk about two-year law schools. I don't think that that's a very good remedy. Some of our local law schools are becoming more and more clinically oriented. I know that the Defender Association hosts a number of clinics from the local law schools, and this gives the law students a sense of representing the poor or the working poor or even the middle class. And that is, I mean, that's really a good solution to helping this problem.
Yeah, just quickly, Kathy.
Yeah, well, in New York, they recently decided that all graduating law students becoming lawyers have to have done 50 hours of pro bono service during a year, and that happens here at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Using law students to help with these problems is certainly an effective resource.
Let me get Alex from media to join our conversation. Jane, thanks for the call. Alex, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I was just wondering, and this may be relevant pertaining to the last comment. My understanding is that attorneys in Pennsylvania or in Philadelphia are required to do a certain amount of pro bono work per year. Would that be helpful? Is that accurate? And would it be useful at all in these cases?
Alex, I appreciate it. Actually, I'm going to toss that to you, Jamie.
There is a movement that does encourage pro bono representation. So that does, and in fact, there are numbers. I know on the civil side, Volunteers for the Indigent Program certainly does that. I love the idea that Mark is talking about with regard to using schools akin to medical schools. So you can actually have seasoned attorneys overseeing the law students and encourage them to get involved in some of this work. But the realities also are, I mean, lawyers, just like everybody else, have mortgages and families and competing interests, and so they have to balance whether or not they're able to stay in practice and earn the living with regards to some of those things that are done. But yes, there is pro bono work that's done. It's not nearly enough, however. It's a drop in the bucket in terms of what needs to be done to address the systemic issue, the societal issue, the political will issue of encouraging better funding so we're not wasting money on the back end through unnecessary incarceration.
Kathy, go ahead.
I would say that lawyers are criticized in our nation a lot, but
yes, they are.
But the truth is that lawyers—it's hard to think of another profession that do as much pro bono volunteer work as lawyers do. Our rules of ethics set expectations for lawyers to do a certain number of hours every year. We in the civil side, representing low-income families and people, we rely heavily on volunteer hours from all sorts of the large law firms, small law firms, solo practitioners. We have a whole organization, VIP, here in Philadelphia, which organizes that and matches up clients who come through my office with lawyers who are volunteering. So I think that lawyers deserve a tremendous amount of credit for stepping into this breach. I mean, we don't expect plumbers or even doctors to do a bunch of free work. And yet, because lawyers are committed to justice, are committed to seeing America's promise and Gideon's promise really made real. Lawyers do a lot of volunteer work to try to deal with these problems. It's not enough, and that's why we really need the funding and the staffed version of this. But I think lawyers deserve credit on this front.
Go ahead, Mark.
I mean, law firms, big and small, are doing fantastic pro bono work, especially in the death penalty area. But we can't run an indigent system on pro bono representation. Now, Clarence Darrow said more than 100 years ago that we'll know we have a fair system when we spend as much on the defense as we do on the prosecution. We don't. And no one ever says, let's have the district attorneys go pro bono here. Let's not pay the judges. I mean, Jamie and I were talking about this earlier today. No one ever says that. We shouldn't be expecting lawyers to be working for nothing. It's not a system that works fairly.
Well, and we're almost out of time here. But to you, Jamie, then is it time to get another case before the Supreme Court, like Gideon of some 50 years ago?
It's always a good time to challenge the Supreme Court in their way of thinking. The question is, what is the current makeup, and whether or not that case could actually backfire.
Or what would that case be?
Well, that's a very good question. I think there needs to be a case that's brought that deals with a systemic funding issue and what really, in terms of what is competent, effective counsel, what does that really mean? Getting the right factual case, something like Gideon, is mm-hmm. going to be something we all should have our eyes on.
There actually was a Supreme Court decision just 2 years ago in 2011 called Turner, which lawyers debate about whether it was a step ahead or a step backwards, because it was someone who was facing prison for failure to pay child support. And the court held that as long as he got some appropriate papers and documents filled out about what his income was and his ability to pay this child support, then he didn't have the right to a lawyer. And that concerns me, because I think it's a step backward from Gideon. And what we're really trying to do is get steps forward, both in terms of more and better representation in the criminal side, but also recognizing all the important civil areas, the most important. We're not talking about every civil case, but the most important cases where people would need a lawyer.
I'm giving you the last word, Mark.
Well, I would not be optimistic about some sort of a systemic challenge at this time in the United States Supreme Court. But, they say all politics are local. And certainly in Philadelphia, we have the wherewithal to expend our resources, in a different way. It's fascinating to see the city hire legal consultants for hundreds of dollars an hour, and yet the city right now is not really willing to pay less than $100 an hour for competent counsel in our most serious death penalty cases. It's ironic, to say the least.
Well, on that note, my thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Mark Bookman, Catherine Carr, and James Funt, as we marked Gideon v. Wainwright, a landmark Supreme Court decision that came down 50 years ago this month. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. In fact, we have posted some photos of our guests on our Facebook page. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. But stay with us. We'll be right back. And coming up next, the advantages and disadvantages of working at home, an issue that's back in the news after the Yahoo CEO said that every